Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm Detroit Economic Cup welcome to Chris and Deanna. Welcome. So Deanna, you start with the warm-up questions, the easy ones. I have a few from the audience.
Okay, and then we'll take the hard ones.
But we'll come to that. Please take it away. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm thrilled to be here. And I want to welcome you, Chris, to Detroit and the Detroit Economic Club.
It's great to be here.
Have you been to Michigan before?
A couple times. No, I grew up in Chicago, so this is like a next-door neighbor. But it's nice to be back and see all the great things the city is doing.
Okay, well, we have a very timely and serious topic to talk about today, the economics of a health crisis, how business must lead in the battle against opioids. And I would venture to say that just about everyone in this room has either been personally affected or knows someone that's been affected by the opioid crisis. I looked up some statistics before I came here today, and according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, in 2017, more than 70,000 Americans died from drug overdoses. Of those, more than 47,000 died because of an opioid overdose. That's about 130 Americans dying every day from an opioid overdose. And those numbers are expected to continue to increase if we don't get a handle on this. So I was very interested to take part in today's discussion, and they told me I'd be interviewing the chairman and CEO of The Hartford. And the first thing I wondered was, he must have a lot of business topics that he could talk about. I wondered why he decided to tackle the opioid epidemic. So let's start with that, Chris. What made you want to take on this topic?
Sure. Well, as it was said in the opening, the Hartford's, I round up, a 210-year-old company that specializes in disability and workers' compensation insurance. And we've seen firsthand sort of the toll that its opioid addiction and abuse has taken on individuals, families, communities, and businesses, and felt the need to speak out about it. We consider our mission sort of underwriting human achievement by providing insurance to people that want to transfer risk to us so that they can pursue their dreams, their passions, and have that insurance respond or prevail when it's needed. So anything that we see complicates that mission, we're going to speak out about it. And I think the simple fact, and everyone would probably acknowledge this, I mean, this opioid crisis didn't develop over the last couple of years. I mean, it's been developing over a decade. And for over a decade, we've been instituting, on a continuous improvement basis, our addiction strategies in our workers' comp and disability businesses, where we focused on building medical networks backed by doctors that are thoughtful prescribers of prescriptions. We've had clinical nurses on staff that really challenge the appropriateness of medical scripts and the necessity of those prescriptions. Our medical nurses also provide education to doctors and individuals or claimants on habits and duration use of these medicines. So. And then lastly, we've invested heavily in data and analytics to be more predictive about the conditions that people might develop an addiction. So you put it all together, and it is a real problem. We feel privileged and honored to at least put it up on a mantle. You gave some statistics on abuse. I'll give a couple of our own. One-third of Americans have been prescribed an opioid in 2017. Research shows that you have a 1 in 5 chance if you take an opioid for greater than 7 to 10 days to develop a habit, a real problem habit. One of the statistics that our analytics and data has produced is we've reduced opioid use in our workers' compensation and long-term disability book of business by 43% over a five-year period of time. So we can implement change. We have capabilities to make an impact, but the reason why I'm here is to elevate this issue because it is a national crisis.
And when a spotlight is shined, there's a story in the media, it usually shows a family that's been devastated, destroyed by opioid misuse and abuse. But a lot of times we don't see about what's going on in the workforce. And do you think that some business leaders are maybe just not aware or they don't realize?
Well, first what I'd say is that this is more of than just a health issue. I mean, it is a business economic issue. No doubt that there's health components, but so that's the first observation. And I think for fairly long, it just hasn't been talked about. You don't really understand what's going on at the ground level. And I would say and I'll give you some examples from my personal experience, that people just aren't comfortable talking about addiction as a disease or as an illness that needs treatment. So through writing op-eds and taking public positions like we have here, we've actually encouraged our people to talk about it. We celebrate National Drug Overdose Day as a means to say there is something here that we could talk about. We could see in our internet internally, people communicating and empathizing with one another, picking up that it's a wider spread issue. So I think ultimately, business leaders really need to understand that there is probably going a lot on with their employees and or family members that affects the the business environment more than anything. I had an opportunity looking at Erin Ridge, who came with me from the Hartford, who is in our HR department. She organized earlier this week for me to sit down with three women that experienced the devastation of addiction personally. Two of them lost a brother or a brother-in-law. One woman lost three brothers and a nephew. I mean, there are stories of the toll, though, not only personally on them, but on the family. The one woman described her younger brother as a hockey player in high school and college and would get dinged up in the hockey games, right? It's a rough sport. Somehow, either through a script or the black market, he was told to take this pill to help pain to allow him to continue to perform at a high level. One thing led to another. He stole from every neighbor in his neighborhood to fuel his addiction. The family was shamed into, what was happening to their son, and ultimately, overdosed. Very similar story with the other woman, brother-in-law, small business owner, a landscape company, got injured on work, took opioids too long. Eventually, developed a severe addiction. That this impacted his elderly mother at 80, who took out a reverse mortgage to finance her son's habits. Went through that. Obviously, started borrowing from other family members, and ultimately, he died of an overdose. But the sister-in-law wasn't sure if it was an accident or if it was intentional. 2 months later, his baby daughter was born. And then the third woman, losing three brothers, all in the greater Hartford area to addiction, and then having it skip a generation to her nephew, is absolutely devastating. And stories like that really make us want to do more. And ultimately, that's why we're here.
I saw another statistic as far as money with businesses that in 2017, the Council of Economic Advisors released a report estimating that the economic cost of the opioid crisis was $504 billion, with lost productivity costing $20 billion. Why is this costing American businesses so much?
Well, I think the first context on that point is, you know, really the human toll. I just gave you, you know, three examples, but it's happening countlessly across America. I mean, the human toll on individuals, families, communities, on businesses. And the toll on businesses, you all know. I mean, it's higher medical cost, it's lower productivity, it's higher absenteeism, it's higher retraining and hiring costs. It all adds up. In an economy of our size, roughly $20 trillion, it's not surprising that it costs, you know, $500 billion a year in economic, you know, output. So the real point on all that statistics is that it's a widespread issue that requires bold thinking, as the Reverend said, new ideas, new solutions, and really, my words I always say, is a multidisciplinary approach to really a complex problem. I think the other statistics, if you don't mind, you know, we've partnered with a group called Shatterproof, which is a non-for-profit organization, actually based in Connecticut also, that is doing great work on the recovery side. Mm-hmm. And we partner with them and have some of their economic models on our website. So if you're a small business owner here in Michigan, you could go to our website, type in sort of the nature of your business and how many employees you have, and it would give you the output of an estimated cost of the epidemic. And I'll give you two examples. If you're a restaurant owner that owns a restaurant, one location, 25 employees. I was at a great one last night, by the way. Selden Standard was great. Anyways, it looks like they have about 25 employees here in Michigan. Their cost would be about $10,000 due to addiction. Again, absenteeism, higher medical, lower productivity, and ultimately replacement cost if person, you know, couldn't get help. If you're a manufacturer here in Michigan with 500 employees, your estimated cost would be $170,000 annually for the same, you know, factors. So it is both a human issue and an economic issue, and that's why we all need to come together.
You mentioned a couple things. What else is the Hartford doing to fight this epidemic?
I would say we're doing three main themes, and we have a lot of help, a lot of, you know, great teammates that are equally as passionate as this internally. So the three, you know, broad categories is one, cultural change, two would be education, and three, sort of action. And I'll explain each of the three a little bit more. So on the cultural change side, that centers around the stigma of addiction and the willingness and the openness of people to begin to talk about it. I said, you know, we've given our employees a platform to, you know, talk about it, but I think a lot of businesses could think about improving that dialogue, that connectivity, that discussion in this area, because it's just not in a person's nature to talk about, you know, something that's not going well. I think on the education side, it is ultimately about trying to empower each of us as individuals that is better prepared to understand the powerful effect of opioids and subscription and how long you really should take these powerful narcotics. So there's a lot of things around, you know, education, including education of doctors, you know, we're advocating for. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, how do we better educate all people? So as I mentioned, Shatterproof also, you know, has 12 questions out on their website that you could look up that says, you know, what are in essence the 10 questions, 12 questions I need to ask before I start taking, you know, this powerful narcotic. Also, there's signs. You know, they have a section in there where you can actually see signs of addiction. So again, I think there's educational materials out there that we'll continue to advocate for. In the last area of action, I'll give you two examples. Action is really, I think, focused on the policy side. You know, getting various policymakers, both at the federal and state level, to understand the nature of the issue, and ultimately advocating for policy change that really limits the dosage and duration of these subscriptions. No one needs a 30-day supply of opioids. And ultimately, you know, to work on what is the solutions or what are the alternative pain relief mechanisms. And then I would say, you know, the other example I would give you is about it's estimated 6 million people have a addiction in the United States, and some of that addiction is actually fueled by the home medicine cabinet. So if an addict is invited over to your house, he or she will likely be going through your medicine cabinet. And if you're like many of us, I mean, you have many scripts in your home cabinet that probably are going unused, unneeded. And working with our drug enforcement agency and sort of their Take Back Medicine Day, there's actually bags, chemical bags that you could put your unused scripts into, put a glass of water, and safely dispose of it. So when you leave here today, we're going to give you your home Take Back Medicine kit so that you could dispose of it. I did it at home. I shouldn't say that. I brought the bags home for my wife, and she went through the cabinets, and we found 60 pills that needed to be disposed of. Wow. 60. Right? You have a wisdom tooth out. You have I had an appendix out, and all of a sudden you didn't realize what you accumulate because you just put it up on your back of your shelf. An addict would find that. If you have an addict in your home, they would find that. So those are some of the things that we're doing.
And obviously when we're talking about sometimes people are overprescribed drugs, like one of the first places that a teenager will get opioids is when they get their wisdom teeth out. They're getting too many. What do you think needs to be done either through the medical profession or the government to sort of help fix this problem?
You know, it's a challenging, issue, right? And I think like anything, it's a habit. I don't know. Maybe it's a habit for the doctors, just to write scripts. Maybe it's a habit that primary care doctors or dentists are seeing 20 to 30 patients a day and they don't have time, to really explore. So I don't think there is one thing. I think it's a combination of activities that need to be focused on that have created the problem and sort of reverse engineer what really needs to stop or what really needs to change. So I think that's the simplest answer I could give right now, Deanna.
And a lot of your employees seem to have a say in this crisis, so that must be helpful. Have they always been on board trying to learn more and be a part of this process?
Yeah, we have a wonderful group of 19,000 employees that are really committed to giving back to the community. It's an important part of our culture as far as some of our sustainability mm-hmm. concepts, both from the environment, both from giving back to our local community, and both for then supporting diversity and inclusion. So it's natural for our people to give in this area. And I would tell you, it's across the board fully supportive. And they're proud of what we're doing. We're proud we're taking a stand. The three women I met with on Monday for lunch all sent me notes basically saying just how proud that they were to work for an organization that was giving a platform for this. So, it is very gratifying and keeps us going.
And it probably helps reduce that stigma that you were talking about by having conversation in your place of business.
No doubt about it. People are comfortable.
How about, though, obviously people are always going to have pain, whether acute pain or chronic pain, and I know you're not saying that they shouldn't ever take medication. What are your thoughts about managing pain?
You guys realize I'm an accounting finance guy, not a medical profession, but I've done a little research. I'll tell you how we think about it, you know, internally in our business, and then I think it could be applicable to other aspects of our economy. So again, in conjunction with Shatterproof, we want responsible use of opioids. We're not here advocating for the take them off the shelves and saying that they have no medical purpose in society. Again, researching these drugs, they were developed in the late 70s, early 80s for end-of-life treatment to comfort those that had basically a terminal illness. Somehow they morphed into, you know, if you get two wisdom teeth out, you know, take, you know, a 10-day script. That's not their intended use. So, first is we always want to make sure that you have alignment on what doctors are prescribing based on the nature of the pain. So again, with our nurses internally, and particularly in our workers' comp business and in our long-term disability, we will continue to question the use of widespread use of opioids for an extended period of time. If there are alternatives, treatments out there, that makes sense. But if you're really dealing with chronic pain, there's usually a root cause of the chronic pain that you have to get at as opposed to just prescribing a pill. And what we've adapted in our claims practices is more of a holistic medicine approach, where we'll have wellness coaches, you know, focused in on biological, psychological, and social aspects of what a claimant might be dealing with, if they're not getting better, if they've been on opioids, you know, too long. So that holistic, you know, medicine, I think, is much better than just, you know, taking a script for a short period of time to deal with chronic pain.
So what do you think business leaders, whether it's a large company or small company, can do to take a first step towards battling this?
Well, you all are in the business world, whether you own your own businesses or work for a larger organization or a school or a community. I would ask you to think about some of the things we just talked about. One, the cultural side of reducing the stigma of addiction. I think you can allow that to be talked about. There's ways of promoting subtly in communications, you know, that these things are okay to talk about, and encourage people to find the right support mechanisms. I'd say, again, the educational side, you could contribute, again, by arming your employees or coworkers with, you know, knowledge about these medicines and how you could take a little bit more ownership in what you put into your body. I think that the third thing that I would really ask you to consider, we're looking at it right now, is just if you have employee assistant programs, EAPs, if you do, great. If you don't, I think you really need to seriously consider adding an EAP program for addiction and mental health. Mental health's not a topic today. I'm not an expert on it. I've just seen, again, firsthand, some issues that this next generation and a lot of people are dealing with mental health issues regarding depression and anxiety at numerous counts that are elevated. So that those EAP programs obviously can provide assistance either through telemedicine, through time off to go into recovery. But I think if we could look at benefits differently and say, what resources can we contribute to the problems from a benefit side that we're willing to spend to have productive workers, to have happy workers? Talent's usually the biggest part of any organization. If you don't have a talented workforce that is committed and productive, I don't think you could win in a competitive society today. So it's both personal, it's business, it's education, it's letting the issue, you know, come to light. It's not buried anymore.
No, you're one of the first business leaders to come out and speak on this topic. How are other business leaders, are they receptive? Are they surprised were they not thinking about it so much within their business organizations?
I think in general, you know, people have a working knowledge of the issue. I would just say that I think to understand holistically the impact on some of the data and statistics, I think that's there's a ways to go there. So again, I encourage, you know, business leaders, and again, it's probably your philosophy too, unless you really measure something and know where you stand today, there's no way to improve it from whatever trend you want to change. So whether you're a large business, a small business, you know, there are ways of partnering with people, like your workers' comp provider, or your long-term care provider, or your pharmacy benefit provider, of actually getting data and knowledge about what's happening, you know, with your employees today. And then obviously committing to a course to change whatever path that you are on, or if it's acceptable, that's great. But generally, there's always room for improvement in understanding what is currently, you know, happening with the employee base today, and then, you know, instructing your partners to really produce a different outcome. If you tell your and we work with Optum. Optum's got great data and analytics. They really do. And they know we're focused on reducing, for our employees, the number of scripts that physicians write for an opioid. They're coming down.
Do you think most businesses have a first aid kit and some have the external defibrillators? Do you think Narcan should be now a part of a first aid kit? And for those that don't know, it can reverse an opioid overdose. It's a nasal spray, and you can get it over the counter without a prescription.
Yeah, I mean, there's been, you know, a lot talked about this. You've probably seen the 60 Minutes report that, you know, really documented how effective, you know, that could be in the situations. You know, it's a little beyond my pay grade. You know, honestly, I don't know what the local requirements are or laws. Part of me says that there are some requirements to have, you know, first aid kits at work, defibrillators. So, but to take that then to, you know, having a pen seems logical. I would again want to do it as a leader of our organization if I really understand the numbers and the addiction, you know, that we have in our employee base today, or figure out another way, you know, to get them some form of medical relief if they have a loved one that became unaddicted, you know, or became addicted and had a shock. To have something hanging on a wall, on an office wall, doesn't seem all that practical to me for, you know, the real problem. But
okay.
That's just me.
We just have about a minute left. Is there anything else that you want to give a take-home message that people can think about when they leave here?
Well, I would say, because I have to give a shout-out, given I'm here in Michigan, is that your governor, legislature, and your police department have been very proactive in this area in passing legislation that deals with providing stricter oversights into subscriptions, providing resources to the medical community and to those being affected by addiction. The state police department that's represented here today has opened up their facilities for addicts, you know, that need care. So there are things being done at the federal and state and national levels that are contributing to that. It's just more that needs to be done. So don't think about education, think about reducing the shame, and thinking about the pro-action and the proactive things that you could do in your place of employment to contribute to this overall problem.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. Now we will continue with a round of questions from all of you. First of all, a question, and you briefly alluded to it, Chris. You spoke about that multidisciplinary approach. In fact, the last 60 seconds of your
I sounded like a McKinsey guy, didn't I?
Yeah, almost, yeah. Absolutely, much better, by the way, much, much better. Do we need a different central institution to coordinate such a multidisciplinary approach is one of the questions we received on the federal level, state level, private sector, which you represent. Who should coordinate so that A, we become more effective, and B, given also the statistics which Deanna outlined, we are much faster in our response to prevent and treat the issue?
I think it's a valid point. If I didn't explain it well enough, our partner Shatterproof is actually taking that on from a treatment side. We're primarily focused on the prevention side of a lot of our activities and questioning the use, but the addiction side, they have made great progress. And I give a shout out to Gary Mandel, their CEO, where they are working on universal standard of care for addiction and developing sort of what they would call the first principles of care for substance abuse. And really what they've done is, it's a complex issue because money comes from the federal government, mm-hmm. vis-a-vis Medicaid, Medicare, mm-hmm. but a lot of the pharmaceutical issues are controlled at the state level. The state levels generally control, obviously, the doctor licensing and programs. So there isn't one overarching body that sort of can say, my words, grace on these things. But through his efforts, he's put the right people at table, at the right people at the table, in a really a mission-driven outcome focus base to say, okay, what do we need to do? Because a lot of what we do today doesn't make sense. So he's had the right 8 or 10 people around the table in most of these states for a dialogue. So that's why we're going to continue to partner with him and support him on the treatment side.
Exactly, and also nationally replicate the model which he has been starting in Connecticut. Another question addresses a very specific opioid bill package which was passed in the legislature season 2017-2018, and I will keep it a bit shorter in the summary description. It was indeed restricting the use of opioids to the public, which at first sight you might argue, that's good. But it also opens doors to search for illegal drugs, and that is actually a side issue which has grown substantially over the last few months and actually years. Any thoughts on that, how we find the balance between a more responsible usage of opioids as a prescription, which we talked about, but also avoiding opening doors to illegal drug usage?
Yeah, I think the legislation, I'll take the legislation first, is last Congress did pass legislation that really reform certain aspects of Medicaid, Medicare related to the financial resources mm-hmm. and how it's used there. They also, again, did provide more resources to medical providers, a little higher requirements and standards on monitoring, and then they also gave additional resources to those that are addicted. So good first step. Now what Congress needs to do, primarily through, I think, the Energy and Commerce Committee, is implement that. So they've passed the standards, but now the hard work of actually implementing is still ahead. So we encourage them to get with into the implementation, the rules, the regulations that they're going to pass from there, and mm-hmm. We're ready to support any other action that the Congress wants to be done. Now you got into the other aspect of what a lot of states have done up front. Is to limit scripts for opioids no greater than 10 days. Mm-hmm. So about 26 states have done that, which is a good first step. 13 additional states have gone as far as to say, we're going to also develop a formula, view it as like a chart, that if you have this condition, this injury, this is the medicine you get. And it's mm-hmm. usually not an opioid. So we call that formularies. So 13 states have actually done that. So then you get into the illegal side of manufacturing, black market. Mm-hmm. I'm out of my league here. I met, I think, a U.S. Attorney General here in Detroit that's been mm-hmm. prosecuting and trying to stop that illicit activity. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the connection can be or is, if there is a connection, but we shouldn't be afraid to limit the legal dosage and duration. And we can have another fight, another battle on the illegal side.
Yeah, we need to fight both
yeah,
sides.
We do.
Agree. Thank you. You briefly also mentioned the importance of, in the world we are living in, of big data analytics, artificial intelligence, machine learning algorithms. The last 2 years, if you reflect what you did at the Hartford, did that really bring substantially new insights, which you translated, I think, in your three-pillar program, culture, education, and action?
Yes, I mean, the data and analytics that we, and the algorithms and the machine learning that we're doing on our larger data sets over the last 5 years has contributed to that 43% decline in our opioid use in our claim activity. So we have our head of claims, John Kinney, with us. He gets all the credit. I take a little credit because we gave him $100 million to invest in a new machine to produce these results. So it was a good partnership.
Good. Great enabling. Thank you. Obviously, healthcare professionals are at the center of the opioid crisis. And you spoke about education. And there is also an inherent, sometimes a conflict with pharmaceutical companies who design, manufacture opioids. And if they're publicly held companies, they are committed to create shareholder value and also maximize profits and monetary value. What is the ethical balance we need to strike between pharmaceutical companies who are indeed operating at that line of profit maximization, at the same time doctors who know the patient, who know the individual patient, and need to make responsible calls?
Yeah, that's a difficult one, because I want to be constructive and helpful for what we need to change going forward and not point any fingers really in the past. So we are where we are. All I really believe in my heart is, you know, we need to change the habits of writing automatic scripts. If there's a misalignment in the incentives, we should look at that. And I would say in this particular area, I might even change the equation from a shareholder-driven model to what's good for the country, what's good for our local communities. Mm-hmm. And in turn, I think that'll be good for our businesses in this area. Mm-hmm. Because I said, or Deanna said it, there's $500 billion of waste created by a misallocation of, you know, these types of narcotics.
Yeah, and it talks to the responsibility of private sector companies also as key entities in a society. It's not only about the shareholder value creation, it is about societal responsibility, for which your company, The Hartford, has been a great role model. The next question is much more around a personal one, Chris, and actually it got the highest number of, actually, call it feedback here from the audience. When you reflect back, even beyond the last 5 years, was there a particular moment, a special moment for yourself, that you realized the depth of the issue, the depth and breadth of the issue?
Yeah, we've had family members, you know, deal with addiction. Mm-hmm. We've had family members deal with mental illness. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say there was an exact trigger, but we've been personally exposed to you know, some difficult issues. So I think then when the data, and when we really got into our data more specifically of just how much abuse was really happening, when people were on scripts, you know, for months and months and years in some cases and aren't getting better, again, John Kinney really opened my eyes into what was happening in our own data set with our own claimants, and we basically said we got to do something about it.
Thank you. Now, a final question. When we move a little bit beyond the business, we look at each other, ourselves. What advice would you have for each of us? What should we do in terms of helping, quote-unquote, address that crisis here on a national level?
Well, you never know where it's going to happen, right? I mean, we've talked a little bit in preparation, so it could be a colleague, it could be a friend, it could be a family member that really needs your support and help. So if you have a little higher awareness, empathy, I think you could do, you know, great things as far as physical support, financial support, treatment support. We have other programs you know, that have patterns and conditions where others could get involved. I think of particularly Al-Anon and some of the alcohol treatment programs. So, but I would say this is just as widespread, if not more, the addiction problem in the U.S. So I think awareness and empathy are probably two big things you could take away today.
Good. Thank you. Very good advice. Thank you, Chris, for answering our questions. Thank you to Deanna again. And now we switch gears lightly to a bit more personal questions, and it is a lightning round, so don't think too much. Short questions, short answers, very spontaneous. There's not a lot of science behind it. But first of all, anything left on your bucket list? What you do?
My bucket list, personal one? I've traveled quite a bit, but I haven't been to Australia and New Zealand, so my wife and I are going to make a trip there.
Good, thank you. Any person other than your family members or best friends you would like to have lunch with? Other than coming back to the Detroit Economic Club? Or?
Yeah, all my friends here. Now, if I had to pick one, it's just Bill Gates. He's just a wonderful humanitarian now, but a great entrepreneur. And I would enjoy having and his wife, Melinda, of course.
We'll see what we can do. Okay. We'll work on that. Well, one of your favorite songs, you don't have to sing, just mention.
I can't sing. I enjoy U2 and the Beatles probably the most. Uh-huh. So U2 would be Beautiful Day, and the Beatles would be Come Together.
It's a good theme also related to the conversation we had about the last 60 minutes here. Favorite team, sports team growing up, which team was
your? I can't say that, I'm in Detroit.
I know that's a little bit of a politically loaded question here, but
I grew up in Chicago, so my dad's side of the family was Cubs fans, my mother's side of the family was White Sox fans, so I've had years of counseling to resolve my conflict. And I am a Cubs fan.
Good. We'll not look at how the next season is going to shape up. We'll see. Your best sport, your favorite sport?
Golf.
Golf, very clear. Last book you read?
I finished, finally. Peggy Noonan's book, Time of Our Lives, which was a collection of her essays and writings over the years, going back 20 years. And maybe like most of you, we read her every weekend in the Wall Street Journal. I think she's just got a wonderful intuitive feel and a touch to what's going on in the broader America. I like some of her stories from the old days. So that was an enjoyable read.
Then favorite vacation spot other than Australia and New Zealand, which is on the bucket list?
Munich, Germany.
Thank you. That's great. No, not from Munich, from Frankfurt, but love to hear it. It's also my favorite city in Germany, Munich. Close to the Alps, great skiing, a lot of great things. Describe Detroit in one or two words.
I know we're close to it, but I would just say Renaissance. Your city's being reborn, reinvigorated. It's the energy is really palatable here, so it is just great to see a city with so much history being reborn and being positioned for success for the next 100 years. So well done to all the community leaders and all the people that contribute to make that happen.
Thank you. Last question. Advice to your 25-year-old self. You know, people in our age, we get those questions. So.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to yourself when you were 25?
I would say be confident in your own skin and what you do.
Confidence. That's a great closing line. Thank you very much, everybody, and we adjourn the session.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was enjoyable.
Thank you.
That went by so quick.
I know. You were great. You did great.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, one more round of applause. Thank you, Chris Swift, for traveling from Hartford, Connecticut to be with us. And thank you for leading in this important issue. Deanna Leitz, always a pleasure having you as a moderator. Hans Werner Kass, always a pleasure having you presiding. Thank you to both of you. Remember, next Thursday, we're going to throw some axes at each other. So I hope to see you then. This meeting is now adjourned. Thank you for coming today.